Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, I Wish the World, an author discussion hosted by Elsa Marston Herwick. On June 22nd, children's author Elsa Marston Herwick hosted a discussion about her works at the Friends of the Library bookstore at the Monroe County Public Library. Elsa has written many books, ranging from children's picture books to young adult novels to nonfiction pieces. Elsa Marston Herwick writes about life in the Middle East and hopes to, quote, focus on interfaith bridge building and finding ways to overcome differences, unquote. She speaks about how she thinks that all children should be read to, and about how children find reading more pleasurable if they see adults reading for pleasure themselves. She speaks about how we all want to make the world a better place, and about how she hopes to do that through her writing. She is the author of The Olive Tree and The Compassionate Warrior, along with many other books. The talk took place at the Monroe County Public Library, and the lecture begins with Library Director Marilyn Wood talking about the accomplishments of the Friends of the Library this year. Community Access Television Services recorded today's lecture.
Good evening, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to say a few words tonight, and to welcome you to our library for the evening. The mission of the Monroe County Public Library is to enrich lives and to strengthen our community by providing equitable access to opportunities to read, learn, discover, and create. And you'll see that mission played out in many of the programs or services that we provide to all ages and to all members of our community. We provide opportunities for our community to prosper. And our physical facilities here in the main library and also at Ellettsville provide spaces for children, for teens, for adults. We have new digital creativity spaces. We have meeting rooms such as this for community activities and events, for opportunities for civic engagement within the community. And our auditorium is a fantastic place for musical events, for theatrical entertainment, for large meetings, for movie watching. Many different things happen in there. And CATS, our Community Access Television station, provides access to electronic media and really keeps our community informed, or helps them to stay informed about things that are happening within the community locally and community events. But we also provide services outside of these buildings, and we are a library for the county. We operate a bookmobile, which makes about 25 stops per week in many rural areas. We operate a homebound service for individuals who have some accessibility issue, and we have community librarians that are in spaces where we're trying to meet information needs anywhere they might be in the county. And all of these really help to facilitate our community's growth and well-being. And in your packet, there's a list, a short list of 2015 highlights of library activity, but I wanted to mention just a few of those key elements. In 2015, we had nearly a million visitors to our libraries. We circulated over 2.5 million items, and our meeting rooms, study rooms, and auditorium were used over 5,000 times. We serve all of Monroe County's 142,000 residents, and just over half of those residents, or about 73,000 people, hold active library cards. We offer dozens of programs for all ages. And last year, we delivered 2,367 programs, and almost 64,000 people attended those programs. But looking ahead, we're not only looking at 2015 activities, but looking ahead, we have many things planned and a lot of opportunities for people to be involved. 2016, all around the library, you will find these beautiful program guides, which are an opportunity for people to check out and really take a look at all of the things that are offered for all ages and in all locations. And we have literally dozens of exciting opportunities to read, learn, discover, and create. And what I've just described to you is really a pretty good measure of traditional library services. You might not be surprised by any of those, but there's more. We are already in the process of transforming this library into some new and exciting ways of delivering service. In March of 2015, which was just over a year ago, although it seems like a long time ago, we opened those brand new spaces just around the corner of the ground floor, which is our teen space and serves ages 12 through 19, and also Level Up, our digital creativity center. Level Up is a place for video and music production, graphic and web design, coding, game creation. It's a new environment for us. We're providing space and equipment to build skills, 21st century digital skills, work skills, and things that are in a free and openly accessible environment. The space has equipment and trained staff to provide help for those who may not either be able to have the equipment or home, or perhaps can't afford it or just don't know how to use it. So many talented individuals have used the space to date. They create web pages. We've had games designed. People have created music videos. But others are learning these skills as novices. And we have staff who help learn or learn alongside them. This is a new way of delivering service for us as well. There, as you all know, there are hundreds of software packages out there. And people bring us questions from probably just about every one of them. So we, too, are learning up. Leveling up. We are helping others to use and create things, and our staff is constantly learning or needs to learn new skills to be able to provide that opportunity for help. The ground floor, which is a place for teens to hang out with their friends and new people, to mess around with digital or analog resources, to geek out making videos, art, games, apps, music. They're learning new lifelong skills of communication, of leadership, and really socialization, positive opportunities for that socialization, all in a new place that they feel welcome and safe, a place that they help design, a place that they feel real ownership of. And changes like ours, both in facilities and in services, are occurring across the landscape of libraries, primarily in public libraries, certainly in public libraries. We're transforming. In fact, the American Library Association actually has a campaign right now called Libraries Transform. And the campaign is to turn outward, to really engage in the community and to listen to the community issues to find out how we can best meet the needs of our community. Not just providing services that librarians might identify as needs, but to hear from the community what the community needs so that we can be in that space to help. Since the library is a place for lifelong learning, and part of our successful transformation is to continue to work with the community to find ways that we can help or do best at problems that we can help solve, we will continue to ask those questions of everyone we meet about what it is that the community is currently facing. Is it to help adults who might be struggling with literacy? Is it how we can best support early childhood literacy needs? Is it a way that we can help the community with a space to be involved with important community issues? Or it's all those things, and the traditional. And so we are continuing to provide lifelong resources, places to gather, work, and study, and programming for all ages. And we're most successful when we find that we are a place in the center of the community, bringing people of all ages together. So in 2016, the services that I've mentioned or that you'll see in the program are happening every day. And we're also looking forward to community conversations about potential renovations at our Ellettsville branch and also a new branch. So more to come on ways that you can be involved in those community conversations. But in all these endeavors, the Friends of the Library supports Monroe County Public Library. You all support us as advocates and speaking with others in the community about the things that we're doing and how we can be better involved in the community. Volunteer efforts are substantial. You'll notice around this room, you'll still see some remnants of the CINDAC, very successful CINDAC exhibit, and we could not have done it if it were not for the help of volunteers from the Friends of the Library. They supported the exhibit in very positive ways. And also, the Friends of the Library provide generous financial support. In 2015 alone, it paid for many patron requests. It purchased book club kits for reading and circulating to the community. It provided training to our volunteers in tutoring adult learners, VITAL program. And it supported staff development. I spoke earlier about the ways in which we need to continue to learn up ourselves. And this is an opportunity for us to continue to support our staff learning in areas of technology or new initiatives and just generally best practices. And it supports all of our programming. It paid for the rental fees for the Maurice CINDAC exhibit. It paid for every second grader in Richland, Bean Blossom, and Monroe County Community Schools to come to the library to see the exhibit and to have a story time. It pays for the summer reading program prizes and books. It pays for snacks to entice teens to come and hang out, mess around, and geek out. So our programs literally reach thousands, and the Friends' contributions are essential to ensuring that we have the variety of programs that we do to provide really for the educational and entertainment programs. The Monroe County Public Library, as you all know, is an exceptional resource for our community, and it's better because of the support of the Friends of the Library. So on behalf of all of the staff of Monroe County Public Library, I say thank you.
Diane Gregory is our vice president of stuff, and she was responsible for getting the speaker, and she's going to introduce our speaker this evening. Diane?
I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for this evening, Elsa Marston Harik, who is a local children's and young adult author. Elsa has been living in Bloomington with her family since 1964. Her husband, Ilya Harik, taught at IU, and his focus on Middle East politics led to much family travel overseas, which served Elsa's career choice well. Her book from 2014, The Olive Tree, was the winner of a Middle East Book Award given by the Middle East Outreach Council in the picture book category. And just 2 weeks ago, at the Bloomington Rotary Club Spring Dinner, she was awarded the Paul Harris Fellow Honor in appreciation of tangible and significant assistance given for the furtherance of better understanding and friendly relations among peoples of the world. Her new book, I Just Kept Walking, which was part of the reason she won this award, will be published by Rotary International in July as its international service project. She'll tell us more about this book tonight. So we'll hear from Elsa. She's going to tell us about her career and books and other interesting topics. Then we'll have a brief question and answer period at the end. So please welcome Elsa Harik.
Good evening. I'm so pleased to be here, so honored to be invited to speak to you, because I know I'm in good company with such local celebrity authors as James Alexander Thom and James Madison. So I feel very good to be one of your guest speakers. I wonder if anybody speculated about the meaning of the title, I Wish the World. Well, I know we all wish the world were a little closer to the way we think it ought to be run. But what gave me the idea for this theme was something I heard on the radio a good number of years ago. It might have been 20 or 30. I was in the kitchen preparing dinner, and there was a program on the radio that seemed to be interviews with kids from disadvantaged backgrounds or situations. I don't remember exactly what it was. And the one that caught my attention was a boy of about 12 to 14 years old. His voice hadn't changed yet, but it was clearly a boy. And he was asked a question or responded to a comment. There was a long pause and then a sigh. And then in the saddest little voice you can imagine, he said, I wish the world was a better place. And it just broke my heart. And I can still hear that voice. I wished I could do something to make the world a little better for that child who was already so unhappy and so hopeless. Well, there's one thing we can all do to make the world a little better, and we know what it is, or we wouldn't be here this evening. It's support our public library. And you all know about that. You've heard some very good pitches already this evening, much better than I could do. So I'm going to move on with another thought about how we can get books into the minds, maybe the hands of children who are not book prone. We know children are more apt to read if the grown-ups in their homes do read books, and if they see adults reading for their own pleasure and interest, not because somebody told them to. This conveys the idea that books are something that ordinary people have, and reading, because they want to, is something that ordinary people do. I was very fortunate to grow up in a home with a lot of books around, some books with wonderful illustrations, which is what I was interested in. My dad was an English professor, and I was allowed to look at and read anything I wanted to pick up. One of those things you take for granted when you're young and you haven't seen very much of the world yet. But many kids don't grow up in homes with books. They're the ones who, above all, need to get the idea that books are interesting, that books can offer something and hold a kid's attention just as much as or more than the video games or whatever it is they do with those things that they hold in their hands. So, in fact, I think reading for pleasure may have to be forced on these kids. And where else but in school? In my own growing up, I was also very fortunate in another way. I went to a school system that was considered one of the best in the country at that time, and probably still is, in Newton, Massachusetts. What I remember with most pleasure and appreciation, though, was my fourth grade teacher, Miss Cutts, bless her. Miss Cutts taught us with enthusiasm about the solar system, about ancient Egypt, about classical Greek sculpture, and she showed us pictures of naked bodies. But nobody protested then. I wonder if they would now. And she read to us for about half an hour every day, real books. The only title I remember is Les Misérables, I assume somewhat abridged, and in English. As soon as we learned that this poor man, Jean Valjean, had been unjustly doomed to the galleys, we were hooked, and we couldn't wait for Miss Cutts to read to us the next pages of Jean Valjean, as we called it, see if he was ever going to have luck turn his way. So this is what I firmly believe, that every child from K through 12 should hear an installment of a good story, preferably ending with a cliffhanger, read by an enthusiastic teacher, not one who just rattles it off, who believes in what she or he is doing every day, or at least a couple of times a week. Because I know teaching is more complicated than it used to be in Miss Cutts' day.
You've been listening to I Wish the World, an author discussion hosted by Elsa Marston Harik on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Thank you. teachers listen to Elsa Marston-Harik speak about how she thinks teachers should incorporate reading into their curriculum. Elsa thinks that every child in school should be read to by an enthusiastic teacher, and she says that children will find more pleasure in reading if they see their adult counterparts finding pleasure in it as well. We return now to Elsa speaking about her efforts to incorporate literature into the lives of young children.
I wish I could say I've devoted my life to this cause. I did once go and see the assistant principal at Bloomington High South and promoted this idea because I believe that adolescents need the quiet time of listening and letting their imaginations work, perhaps even more than younger children. I got lots of nice smiles and yes, yes from the assistant principal, but nothing further. So I can't claim that I have really made a cause of this idea, except on occasions such as this. But if anybody's looking for a cause and an enjoyable one, why not promote the story half hour in every day in every school? Mightn't it have made the world a little better place for kids like the boy I heard on the radio? Wouldn't it have helped him see a wider horizon of this world and start to wonder what might lie beyond the limitations of his own world? And maybe even think about what he could do to start to find out? I would like to think so. Now I'm going to tie my own writing to the tale of that lofty kite, making the world a better place thanks to books for young people. When I first started to write a novel for kids back in the 70s, I had some vague idea about making the world a little better. We were living in Carthage at the time. Now, how many of you have a very clear idea of where Carthage is? A few hands. It's in Tunisia, about maybe 15 miles up the coast from Tunis, the capital, where all the excitement of the Arab Spring started. And Tunisia is still in the news from time to time, but it's one of the places where the Arab Spring seems to have taken root. And Carthage was the great enemy of Rome. The Romans thought that Carthage was a dire threat, and so they should wipe it out. But we're not going to get into that. But we were living on the historic hill at the center of the city where the Romans fought their way, slaughtering the Carthaginians left, right, and center up to the top. And it was a place that was redolent with the sense of the past and a violent past, too. I was so in love with the place, I decided to write a novel set in present-day Carthage so that young Americans would know about this fascinating place and its history. I made it the sort of mystery adventure that I liked as a child, about unusual, exotic places where unusual things happened. I finished the book, and over the years, it's gone through about 1,000 revisions and polishings. It has aroused the interest of some noteworthy editors, which was a lot easier in those days, but it has never found a home. I still believe in it, but I have a feeling that much as I love the story, it's a little old-fashioned in today's publishing industry. Although the themes are as timely as ever, the looting of antiquities, self-delusion, a young teen developing more confidence in himself, and the main character, the young teen, was named after my son, Ramsey. My second novel, and the first one published, was called The Cliffs of Cairo. And it used a lot of my experiences living in Cairo during the Nasser regime, which was a time of great austerity. There were long periods, weeks, months, when you couldn't get eggs or tomatoes or bread or anything else, but somehow you survived, and it was a wonderful year to be there. It doesn't sound like it, but it was. The story has been republished twice and almost recently a third time by a new ebook publishing venture developed by responsible and experienced editors, but they didn't get the support from teachers that they needed, and the project failed. That sort of thing happens quite often. Anyway, I couldn't find the original book, but here is the paperback, the first paperback, and I think this cover would not fly in today's market because you can see it has a very derogatory view of the villain, who is clearly one of them, Muslim. But by that time, I had decided on my mission as a writer, to help young Americans be more aware of other places, particularly the Middle East, where the United States has been involved politically for decades, and about which many Americans are utterly ignorant or misinformed. Thus, they regard the Arab world as incomprehensible, but a violent place, and its people all either whining victims or fierce enemies. Mr. Trump has said some corkers of things like that. I felt, and I still do, that if I could help even a handful of kids and adults to share my own fascination with the Arab world, the history that goes back thousands of years, the culture and the current developments for the good on one hand, and on the other, the disasters. And if I could help even a handful of Americans to think of the people of the Arab world not as inscrutable and violent people, but people like us, dealing with the same sort of needs, interests, strengths, and weaknesses that we face and cope with, if that handful of Americans could think of the people of the Arab world with better understanding and less fear, I felt, and still feel, a little bit of the world could become a better place. Some of my work, especially my picture books and some articles, are not about the Middle East. They're about ideas that just caught my fancy and amused me, such as a griffin in the garden, which is still my all-time most popular book, and Cynthia and The Runaway Gazebo, which was made into a musical and had its premiere at the Peterborough Players Summer Theater in New York. Not New York.
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Thank you. But other than those, I have stuck to my mission pretty well. Come hell or high water, or more likely come frustration and disappointment at times. What made it easy and natural for me to specialize in writing about the Middle East and about children's and young adult literature about the modern Arab world was the fact that my late husband, Leah Harik, was from Lebanon. We met at the American University of Beirut. I think Diane did mention that. He was also a Middle East specialist, a political scientist here at IU, And he had many opportunities to do research and other assignments in the Middle East, which gave our three sons and me the chance to live and travel in such places as Tunisia, Cairo, and Lebanon. We spent summers occasionally with Aliyah's family at their home in the beautiful mountains of Lebanon and made occasional side trips. And I'm particularly thankful that we saw Palmyra before ISIS got their hands on it. It may not have meant much to most Americans, although I do see some people nodding, but it was just shattering to think of ISIS wrecking that place, which was pretty spectacular. One year we lived on a historic houseboat on the Nile in Cairo, and all these experiences could be worked into or even provide the main setting for my stories and articles for children's magazines, such as Highlights and Cricket, and collections of YA stories. Aliyah was interested in what I was doing, and he was supportive, which certainly helped make our private world a better place. Another aspect of my mission has been to collect children's and YA books about the modern Arab world and to maintain an up-to-date list of recommended books. I'm happy to say that since the 1990s, there has been a huge increase in the publishing of good books that give a reasonably accurate and fair picture of people of the Middle East and North Africa. And previously, there was virtually nothing. A very few novels, which were very good. But anything else that was published about Arabs was derogatory. But that's another story. Except that I've used this material and my interest in promoting it for many articles and talks. From time to time, I've been asked to write an article or a book about the Middle East. For instance, Women of the Middle East, co-authored with my son Ramsey, published in two editions by Franklin Watts. This is the first one, and this is the second one, which I did in a very short time. It was a tough summer. And a historical biography of the Prophet Muhammad, which is here somewhere. Ramsey did a historical biography of Jesus. This was supposed to be the start of a series that an editor at Franklin Watts wanted to do about the founders of world religions, which would have been very interesting. But our books were the only ones that were published because her higher-ups pulled the rug out from under her feet. So even editors have their disappointments, too. I wrote three books in the Cultures of the Past series published by Marshall Cavendish on the ancient Egyptians and the Phoenicians and the Byzantines. And to do research for the Byzantines, I got somebody to take me to the dungeons of the famous Byzantine emperor of the 12th century, I think, Alexis Comnenus. And there was no light in those dungeons. It was pretty scary. I loved doing those books and was so sorry when the publisher decided that they'd done all the cultures. Of course they hadn't. They barely started. What was interesting about these Cultures of the Past books is that they don't just focus on the history. They focus on the thought system, the religion and mythology and what makes people tick, or think anyway, and how those thought systems played out in the society and any echoes in today's society. So it took quite a bit of thinking on the part of the writer, too, to analyze and come up with explanation. Another biography I was asked to write a few years ago was The Compassionate Warrior, Abdelkader of Algeria. I see the book back there, which is nice. It was published by Wisdom Tales, which is a publisher here in Bloomington. They have their offices at the Deer Manor on, you all know where that is. Yeah. I had known about this man, Abdelkader, since my graduate school days when I was doing research for a paper on education under in Algeria under the French colonial rule, which was pretty lousy. But you can't learn anything about Algeria in the 19th century without learning something about Abdelkader. He led the resistance to the French conquest of his country in the 1830s and 40s. And he was only 24 or 25 when he started out. It dragged on for years. And he was a most remarkable man and a hero in every sense. And when he was through fighting, he was a cultural and religious bridge builder. He really wanted to know and understand about other religions and create a positive atmosphere in which people could talk very freely. Eventually, he was exiled to Damascus, and in 1860, there was an outbreak of sectarian massacres. Now, you may think horrible things are always happening in Syria, but that is not true. This event in 1860 was, until recently, was the most horrific outbreak of violence in that country. Anyway, it was Muslims against Christians, and Abdelkader and his followers personally went out into the streets of the Christian quarter, which was in flames and being wrecked all over the place. And they rescued several thousands, maybe as many as 12,000 of the local Christians and saved their lives. And this made him even more of a hero than ever. And the United States, seeing him as a man of peace, sent him a brace of pistols. Now, one of the announcements of my talk mentions this book, and the other one that was also published by Wisdom Tales, The Olive Tree, a picture book that takes place in Lebanon following the long, long civil war of the 1970s and 80s. Two very different kinds of books, but both with the theme of reconciliation and bridge building. The Olive Tree is about two families who live next to each other in a Lebanese village. And there is an ancient olive tree that grows right between, right next to the wall between their houses. And because olive trees often twist here and there, some of its branches drop their olives in the yard of the family that does not actually own it. But the family that does own it has gone away during the war because they feared persecution because they were of a different religion from the majority of people in the village. And the children of the two families quarrel over who has the better right to the olives, and they feel some hostility toward each other. And then one night, the tree is struck by lightning, and then the two kids swallow their pride, and they find a way to start to mend. This story, which I wrote in the mid-90s when Lebanon was just starting to heal, has won two national awards and several reprintings, and at last it's a picture book, so I'm happy and won't fuss anymore about it. Now I'm going to say something about a mystery. And if anyone in the audience can enlighten me, please do so. When I wrote the historical biography of the Prophet Muhammad, and later the biography of Abdelkader of Algeria, I thought the Muslim community, or communities, because I think it's probably wrong to lump everybody in one entity, in the United States would welcome them, because as we know, the Muslims get a bad press in some quarters. And there were, and still are, virtually no books or historical books about the Prophet Muhammad, let alone a Muslim hero for whom his religion was a very important part of his life. But so far as I can see, there has been no interest in these books whatever among Muslim groups. And my efforts to bring them to their attention have gotten nowhere. I was hoping there might be some Muslims here who could offer some light on that puzzle, but it disappoints me and mystifies me. So I have no evidence that these books helped make the world a little better, but I certainly had my hopes and expectations, and I really enjoyed researching and writing them. I'll wind up by telling you about two books that mean a lot to me. Remember Miss Katz, who read us Les Misérables? Another book she read us was about ancient Egypt, an ordinary boy who had some wonderful adventures and brought that fascinating ancient culture vividly to life for us. I was so fascinated, in fact, by that story that I decided to write a novel myself about a boy in ancient Egypt. Since I was only 8 or 9, the novel didn't get much beyond 2 pages. But I never forgot that at least I tried. Many years later, while living in Cairo and having seen something that intrigued me in the Cairo Museum, I settled down to write a young adult novel set in a different time, not the time of King Tut and Queen Hatshepsut and Ramses and all those old folks that we know so well, but one of the very late dynasties that we don't know much about, but which was a very fascinating time. My story, called The Ugly Goddess, here she is. She's no beauty. Was about a poor boy who worked in the studio of a famous sculptor, sweeping up and just doing all the dirty work, and a handsome young Greek soldier, because at that time the pharaohs, who had ambitious schemes of conquest, were using a lot of Greek mercenaries for their adventures. A beautiful young princess who is being forced for political reasons into a marriage that she doesn't want, and a statue of a goddess that has been commissioned for her on this occasion. The story was published by Cricket Books and got good reviews, What most amused me was the realization, when it was completely done, that at last I had finished the novel that I started when I was 8 or 9. It hadn't occurred to me earlier. So there's a little morale to this story. You may not realize your dreams when or exactly how you want to, but someday, maybe very unexpectedly, a dream may at last come true. So hold on to your dreams. And I like to say that when I'm talking to kids about this book. Would you like to know what it was I saw in the Cairo Museum? It was, every month they had a thing of the month displayed prominently near the entrance. And one time when I went there, it was a statue of this goddess, whose name is Tawaret, who is a combination of a lion, a pregnant hippopotamus, a human, and a cow, all attributes of the different Egyptian gods. And very strange. And this statue was made at the time of this dynasty in the 6th century BC, when the story takes place. And it was made, although I didn't know it at the time, as a gift to accompany the princess, who really was a real person, who really was being forced into this ritualistic marriage. And it was absolutely perfect. There wasn't a nick or a scratch or anything wrong with this statue. And I was so impressed by it, I just had to write a book about it. The other book I'm especially keen on started out as a collection of 5 stories about teenagers in different Arab countries, all of which I had lived in or visited over the years. That book, Figs and Fate, Stories About Growing Up in the Arab World Today, was published by a well-known literary publisher in New York, George Braziller, who does not do children's books, but he liked my stories. And it was well received. There was and still is nothing else like it, and sold out, at which point, to my amazement, Janet Rabinowitch at the IU Press picked it up. But the IU Press wanted a longer book, so I added 2 stories that had already been published in other collections and wrote a 3rd story about an honor crime in Jordan. Do you all know what an honor crime is? Yes. And retitled the book Santa Claus in Baghdad, the title of one of the stories, and other stories about teens in the Arab world. I suppose I should have foreseen it, but I didn't. The story set in Jordan, Honor, unfortunately inspired reviewers to focus too much on the weak points of the culture, although honor crimes are found in many different cultures in Asia and Africa too, I think, to focus on the weak points of the culture and to comment on the oppression and hardships of growing up in the Middle East. Whereas I had hoped readers would be more impressed by aspects that we Americans could relate to. But the book is still giving me rather nice royalty checks, as these things go. And I do feel that this book has contributed a bit to making the world a better place by encouraging American readers to take an interest in their young peers in the Arab world. I did not write about what we see and hear in the news all the time about the Arab world. War, violence, terrorism, suffering, corruption. But although the political and social background is there, the focus of the story is always on more universal experiences that young people face in Arab culture, American culture, and virtually all modern cultures as they are growing up, such as fitting in at school or dealing with parents' divorce, finding a good friend, reconciling one's own ambitions with one's family's expectations, and things that we can relate to. So the book serves fairly effectively, I think, as a cultural and emotional bridge builder. And the thought keeps me going. Now, I had not planned to talk about the book. I just kept walking because it's so complicated to tell people about. But I will tell you, I will not leave you dangling and wondering what on earth they thought I had done to deserve a Paul Harris. It's a story about two boys, one real life, a Bloomington boy, Morgan Shearer. You probably know him and read about him in the paper 3 summers ago when he set out to hike the last 500 miles of the Appalachian Trail and raise money to support a school in the capital in a slum, a former refugee camp, near the capital of Kinshasa, the capitals of, near Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And he raised $10,000 and had a great time. So that's one story. And the other story, which is told in alternative first person, is fictitious. It's about a Congolese boy whose village has been attacked by fighters in the east of the Congo and who has escaped with his mother and his sister. And somehow they make their way westward where they think they'll be safe. Of course, nobody could walk across the Congo. So a good deal of the trip is by boat, which is arduous enough. And they end up at this refugee camp, and the two kids go to the are lucky enough to go to the school that Morgan's pledges have gone to support. Now, the school is supported by the Bloomington Rotary Club and another of the Bloomington Rotary Clubs. There are three. And a Rotary Club in Washington, not D.C. or the Northwest, but Indiana. And the Kinshasa Rotary Club, and very recently a Rotary Club in Bayreuth, of all places, Germany. So it is truly an international project. And it's not just building cabinets and benches and the infrastructure. They're developing an innovative curriculum that focuses on the real-life problems and situations that the kids see all around them, such as water. Think of all the things you could learn about water, or trash disposal, or nutrition or health and everyday problems, and they work that theme, which the kids choose, into the curriculum each year. So the organization Giving Back to Africa, do many of you know about it? It was started by Anne Marie Thompson and her husband, who grew up in, Anne Marie grew up in the Congo, and she loved it and the people so much that she wanted to help the children by starting this organization, which would have a focus on education. So with the help of Giving Back to Africa, they are developing this innovative curriculum, which will, if all goes well, be like a pilot project and inspire other schools in Africa, or at least the Congo, to do likewise. So my story was fun to write. I interviewed Morgan and combined my imagination with the facts of his trip to make it as exciting as I could. And I just made up the other story, but with Anne Marie's help and to make it authentic, or as authentic as possible. And it turned out to be a lot better than I was expecting. In fact, people seem to like it. And we hope that it will be published in July.
Thank you all very much for listening, and thanks to Elsa for her wonderful presentation. We thank you all.
You just listened to Elsa Marston Harik give a lecture at the Friends of the Library bookstore at the Monroe County Public Library. She was the guest speaker at the Friends annual meeting this year. The talk began with Library Director Marilyn Wood discussing the accomplishments of the library this year. Elsa then talked about her books, literature in schools, and making the world a better place. The meeting took place on June 22nd. Community Access Television Services recorded today's lecture.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.